My next guest is Frederick Vatisse. He's the chief actuary of Morneau Chappell and has spent his entire career providing retirement consulting and actuarial advice to human resources and pension plans. He's written the book, The Essential Retirement Guide, A Contrarian's Perspective, and I've asked him to join me today for that reason exactly. It's a contrarian's perspective to a lot of the information that you hear as you go about your daily life reading material on retiring. Welcome to the show, Frederick.
Good morning, Steve.
So you've spent your life as an actuary, and I don't think a lot of people really know what an actuary does. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the actuaries are the people who crunch all the numbers behind the scenes for insurance and pensions. So, for example, as a pension actuary, I would be the one who would be telling my clients how much they have to be funding their pension plans in order to make sure that they can pay out all the benefits. Insurance actuaries would be the ones who figure out the premiums for life insurance and such.
So how does this work on an ongoing basis? I mean, it seems to me that once you've kind of done the calculations, you're kind of done. So what are some of the other things that an actuary has to do in order to make sure they're giving the best advice?
Well, first of all, the funding recommendations are ongoing because the situation keeps on changing. Your prognosis of future investment returns will change. Mortality tables change. The client's own situation will change because they're funding a pension plan and they have pension assets, and they may not grow as fast as we assumed they were going to grow, or they may grow faster. So that goes on. But the other thing we do, too, is give them ongoing advice about pension plan design so that they have something that actually works for their employees.
Sure. So you see the retirement situation, or in some cases dilemma, from a completely different point of view. You're looking at the big numbers and actually able to quantify what's actually going on versus some of the myths that surround retirement, and also a lot of the information that comes from what you call vested interests. When you read the information that's out there that's available to the general public and you think about these vested interests, what are you talking about there?
If you look at the websites for the big mutual fund companies, and I guess you'd know the names, they'll tell you that people need a retirement income target of 75% of their final pay. That's how much income they need in retirement.
Yeah.
Then if you scroll down or look at some of the attachments, you find out how they got to those numbers. And it just doesn't make any sense. So I mean, as an actuary, that's one of the things we do. We crunch numbers, and I work them out, and it just... it's impossible that it could be anywhere close to 75% as the conventional target.
Well, that's important. So let's talk about that. So you have the average person and they're thinking about what their income is right before retirement, and they're just trying to make some kind of a calculation in the future. Exactly how much am I going to spend in retirement? And so you think, well, I'm not going to spend 100% of what I'm spending today, but 75% sounds like a reasonable figure. Why is that number so wrong?
Well, because your average person who, let's say, has somewhat above average income, ends up spending only about 35% of their gross income on themselves during most of their working career. Because you break it down. First of all, a big chunk of it, maybe, let's say for somebody earning $100,000, to pick a round number, they might be paying $20,000 to $25,000 in income tax alone. Call it $20,000.
The first haircut off that 100% is taxes, right?
Right. Okay. Income tax, yeah. Mm-hmm. Second haircut is going to be child raising expenses. And if you have a couple of children, it's going to be $15,000 or $20,000 a year on average. And obviously, anyone who's puts their kids in private schools or summer camps knows that number could be a lot bigger than that. But that's going to be another $15,000 or $20,000. Then there comes mortgage payments that typically go on for 20 or 25 years. And that's another $20,000 off of that number.
Okay.
And finally, there's actual saving for retirement itself. So when you take all those numbers off, you're only left with about 35% of your gross income that you can spend on yourself. Now, in retirement, all those things I just mentioned go away, or they should go away. You should have your house paid off. Your children should be self-supporting by that point in time. You're no longer saving for retirement. And finally, even income taxes end up being a lot less in retirement because of for all kinds of reasons.
So there's a huge difference when you're calculating your future needs for retirement. If you're using, let's just use your $100,000. If you're using the need for $75,000 of income, I mean, how much money would you have had to accumulate to support that $75,000, assuming no other sources of income like Social Security? versus having only to support 35,000. So do you think that a lot of the calculations as to how much people are going to need are overstated because of that?
Well, there's no question that the retirement income target is overstated for all the reasons we just mentioned. The actual amount in dollar amounts and dollar terms might actually still be significant. I call that the wealth target in the book, i.e. the lump sum amount of money that you need at the point of retirement to meet all your needs in retirement.
Yeah.
And the reason why that lump sum amount is still going to be large in future is because we're not going to be seeing 8 or 10% returns anymore as we have in the past. In the book, I outline why interest rates are going to be staying low for the next 20 or 30 years.
I'm going to get into that in a minute.
And we'll talk about that later. But because of that, the amount you actually need is still going to be substantial. So good news, income target low.
Mm-hmm.
Bad news, the amount you need to even reach that low income target is still substantial.
You know, we do a lot of modeling for retirement of this nature. And one of the aspects that you mentioned in your book was the fact that spending does decrease with age. So here we are, number one, looking at the retirement income target as being less than expected, let's say from 75% down to 35 or 40%. But even that 40% that you're spending over the years as you get into your 70s and 80s and so on, that actually declines as well. So how does that affect the retirement calculation?
Well, the way it affects it is that the number ends up being lower, and I estimate it would be lower by 10 or 15%. Versus if spending did not decline. And when I talk about spending declining, I mean in real terms, like after inflation. So now there have been site studies from Germany, the United States itself, and Canada in the book. And I talk about how the tipping point seems to be ages 70 to 74. So up until that point in time, your spending does keep on going up. So you retire in your 60s and you keep on spending at the same rate pretty much for the first 5 or 10 years of retirement. But then you reach that tipping point, and after that, you start spending less. And there's another recent study that was very extensive, very robust from the UK that shows the same thing. Same tipping point, 70 to 74, and then declined less spending in your 70s and 80s. And the reason why people spend less is not because they have less money, because they actually end up saving a higher percentage of their pay when they're 80 than they ever saved when they were 45, which of course is ridiculous.
Why is
and
that?
The reason why they do it is because they just don't seem to want to spend as, or maybe can't spend as much anymore. And so all the various studies are citing the same things. They're saying, you know, you're hobbled by arthritis, by Parkinson's, by whatever it might be. Your spouse might have died. You have less interest in traveling and so on.
Yeah.
There's less inclination to spend and less ability to spend once you reach about age 75, roughly.
Yeah. And I guess you kind of have all the stuff you've ever needed in your whole life, pretty much.
Yeah.
You've bought everything. Mm-hmm.
You're not buying sofas anymore.
Yeah.
My parents didn't buy any sofas for the last 40 years of their life.
The book is The Essential Retirement Guide, A Contrarian's Perspective. My guest is Frederick Vitese, a chief actuary, which he does for a living, and he's written this book from an actuary's point of view. You mentioned investment returns in the future. One of the key inputs when trying to figure out what future rates of return are going to be is the amount of return you're going to earn on those savings. And you stated in your book that you think that interest rates are going to stay low for the next 20 years. That's quite a statement. Why do you think that?
Well, first of all, I'd say that whenever anybody is giving you an investment forecast and they say this time it's different, you always have to be suspicious because it almost never ends up being different. This time it actually is different, and that's because of demographics. What's happened is our population is aging, and very generally, people over age 50 tend to be savers. And people under age 50 tend to be borrowers. For the past half century or longer, we've had a lot more borrowers than savers because we've had a fairly young population here in North America and even in other parts of the world like Japan. So lots of young people means lots of borrowing going on for student loans, car loans, and mortgage payments, and so on. And so there was a lot of demand for money. And then it's just a supply-demand equation. The higher the demand, the higher the interest rates. So 25 years ago, we would have seen real interest rates after inflation on safe bonds of, say, 4 or 5% real interest rates. Today, real interest rates are just about 0%. And the reason is because our population has aged.
Yeah.
This is a worldwide phenomenon. We actually should have seen this coming long ago because it started in Japan in the 1990s, where they reached their own tipping point in terms of an older population in around 1992, 93. And they've had extremely low interest rates, say around 1% nominal rates on bonds for the past 25 years.
Frederick, it seems to me that, you know, want to make sure that we understand that we're not painting with too broad a brush here. I mean, the United States is not Japan with regards to demographics. I mean, they have a much older population. We have much higher immigration rates than they do. And I'm not going to, you know, I don't have the facts in front of me to argue these points, but these are the things that I noticed and that I have read. And also, I mean, it's not just domestic trade anymore. It's worldwide trade, and corporations need money to expand and to borrow. So, you know, it seems like the main thesis that it's just demographics seems to be, you know, a little bit too singular.
Well, first of all, the U.S. is not Japan. However, it seems to be the same tipping point everywhere. So Japan, if you look at the population over 50 versus under 50, and you take that ratio, the tipping point seems to be 40%. So when you have more than 40% are over 50, that's when interest rates really seem to take a dive.
Okay.
So that's what happened in Japan in 1993.
Right.
It happened in Canada around, I think, 2010. It happened in Europe a little bit earlier. And lo and behold, ever since the Great Recession of 2008-2009, we see interest rates that are around 1% or 2% pretty much everywhere in the developed world. Now, U.S. has now reached that 40% tipping point in terms of the demographic ratio I just mentioned.
Right.
And you talk about world trade, and it's not just one country. So you might think that, well, maybe China's going to bail us out because China's got a young, dynamic population, huge growth, and they're going to export all that. Even China, which has always had a very low ratio of savers to borrowers, is going to be over that 40% tipping point by the year 2020. So it's going to be a worldwide phenomenon.
So we have to get all our children and grandchildren to procreate, I guess. That's going to be the answer to this. So another input when trying to figure out the viability of your savings and retirement is your expected lifespan. Now, in your book, you pointed to a site that you can actually put in some criteria and it'll tell you what the average, what you can expect for your lifespan. But seriously, I mean, nobody really knows how long their lifespan is going to be. So how would you recommend people thinking about that in the calculation?
The way I would recommend it is for the vast majority of us, I would just assume it's going to be, I guess, an average lifespan or maybe even a bit more than average. And as a result of which, it means that we want to be thinking about certain kinds of instruments like buying an annuity. For a small proportion of people, they kind of know that they're going to have a shorter lifespan. If you're grossly overweight, you've always been a smoker, you've got emphysema, there's other problems going on,
cardiovascular
disease and so on. And you, if you just know you're not going to have the average lifespan, then you may want to be avoiding buying annuities. But for most of us, we expect it's going to be average or higher.
Let's talk about annuities for a second. But before we get into that, so what is the average lifespan for a male these days who attains the age of 60?
So for a male who attains the age of 60, it would be around 22 years, roughly.
So 82 is the average.
Yeah, roughly. But 82 if you got to age 60. Yeah, 82.
Okay.
And for a woman, it might be more like 86.
Okay. So, I mean, those are averages. So it's really difficult. How many, I guess, half live longer and half don't, right? So
that's exactly what it means.
Yeah.
What the average means.
So what is the chance when you get to a certain age, like let's say when you get to 85, what are the chances of you living to age 95? I mean, it must diminish pretty quickly.
Well, if you got to 85, your chances of getting to 95 are a lot better than they looked when you were only 60.
Yeah. That's but a George Burns quote.
The interesting thing is what's happened is mortality has been getting a lot better at the older ages for the past 20, 30 years. By the way, this is more true in, say, Canada and Europe than it is in the United States. And it's been a bit of a quandary as to why the U.S. is lagging the rest of the world in terms of mortality improvement.
Yeah.
Could be all kinds of reasons. But in any event.
Well, that's a complicated issue to discuss in 2 minutes. Right. So, you know, you mentioned the word annuities, which is kind of a dirty word these days, especially, you know, the kind of the tax-deferred annuities. Immediate annuities, which pay you a guaranteed payout, I think, you know, have a lot to say for themselves, but they are quite expensive because of low interest rates these days. Why do you still recommend them?
Well, you know what? The low interest rates shouldn't really have any bearing on whether you buy an annuity or not, because what are you going to do with the money otherwise? A lot of people are putting their money into fixed income instruments anyway. Might be bonds or it might be some kind of guaranteed certificates.
All right, I'll buy that, but let me ask you this question. Generally, the annuity payout, you're kind of getting your own money back for a rather long period of time. So it's a bet that after that period of time, when you've actually received your own money back, that's a bet between you and the insurance company. But that period seems, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's in the favor of the annuity holder. It's more in the favor of the insurance company.
Right. So the break-even age might be around 80, 85, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But here's the thing about that bet. If it pays off for you, i.e. you live a long time, then you're going to enjoy the rewards. If you lose the bet, it's only going to be because you die early. And so you actually aren't going to be suffering having lost the bet because you're dead.
But the value of the payout decreases because of inflation starting at age 85, you know, because it constantly gets worn away because the value of a dollar is worth less in the future. So you may get money for the rest of your life, but the value of that money is greatly depleted.
I don't think anybody should be putting their whole nest egg into an annuity. I kind of like the idea of putting in about half of your savings into an annuity and the other half you keep on investing. And the business about it not being inflation protected, based upon the earlier argument that we spend less as we get older, that's okay. Because you still have your other half of your savings. And on top of that, you've got Social Security, which is indexed to inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have enough indexation to meet your needs.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but these are wonderful points to consider. My guest, Frederick Vitisse, Chief Actuary of Morneau and Chappelle. And to learn more about Frederick and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Frederick.
Thank you.